Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Welcome to the Insomnia Project. Sit back, put your feet up, put your hands behind your head, and just relax and chill as we have a calm conversation. And hopefully, this will help you find your way to a restful, peaceful, and possibly sleep-filled part of your day. Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Marco Timpano, and I have the extreme pleasure of inviting and having as my guest a good friend who I haven't seen in a while because he now lives in California, Paul P.K. Kingston. Welcome to the Insomnia Project.
Thanks so much for having me, Marco.
And Paul, I'm probably going to refer to you as P.K., which a lot of your friends call you, and so that's the first name that comes to mind. So I hope you don't mind if I refer to you as P.K. in this episode.
Of course.
Fantastic. Now, P.K., you have a love for weather.
I do.
And I need to know more about that.
I would say my interest in weather probably was first born when I was a young kid. My family has a cottage in the northern part of Ontario. And growing up, you know, we would spend summers there. And we have a property that's just on the lake. And, you know, when I was very, very young, obviously, you know, as most children are, when you hear a thunderstorm, you know, you get spooked by it. But I very quickly learned to sort of embrace the sort of beauty of a thunderstorm and watching it like roll across a lake and being able to time out the thunder and the lightning with the distance of the storm and so on and so forth. And yeah, over time, it very quickly became sort of the most soothing sound that I could possibly think of, to the point that I just, you know, sometimes will even put on artificial soundtracks of rainstorms just as
sure.
A calming and sort of soothing thing if I need it.
Have you noticed a difference in the rain patter that you hear now that you're on the West Coast versus when you were here in the northeast part of North America?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I will say first off, being in California, you know, rain is a little fewer and far between.
Sure.
And it was back in Toronto. But yeah, when the storms do come here, you know, it's like sometimes they are, you know, very, very heavy or extremely light. Whereas back in Ontario, one of the most beautiful things that I used to find about rainstorms was just the waves of them that would come in off of Lake Ontario, and you know, you could sort of watch the gradual increase and decrease of it, almost as if it was like a, you know, well-coursed sort of symphony kind of thing of percussion, and yeah.
So, do you watch the Weather Channel?
I don't watch the Weather Channel, but I do have like the multiple weather apps on my phone, so I can sort of track the kind of things that are going on. I also spent a good time back when I was in my late teen years working at a summer camp where I was a nature instructor and actually was reading up on the weather in order to sort of teach kids how to predict weather patterns while on canoe trips and such.
All right, then I need to know some of that. You know, I'll share with you a little story. When I was a tour guide in Italy, we would be riding bikes. It was a cycle tour that I was leading, and weather would be predicted for the next day. Rain, I should say, not weather, but rain was predicted, and heavy rain. And I remember talking to a friend who was around, a colleague, let's say, and I was like, it's supposed to rain really bad tomorrow. And she turned to me and she said, hang on, I'm going to call my friend who's a fisherman. And I was like, what? She's like, if anyone knows what the weather's going to be like tomorrow, it will be the local fisherman. And she called me back and she said, the weather's going to be fine. And I said, but all the newscasts are saying it's going to be terrible. And she was like, mark my words, it'll be fine. And sure enough, we had perfect riding weather the next day.
Yeah. Yeah. And it goes to show you can never really underestimate the knowledge and of those who live it. You know, I mean, a lot of weather broadcasts are done, you know, these days by computer and data and so on and so forth. But weather really is one of the very unpredictable things that are out there, and things can shift in a matter of moments, depending on various factors. And so it is one of those things where it's like, you know, learning to be able to spot patterns in weather as opposed to relying on data can sometimes actually be much more reliable in regards to sort of figuring out what might be coming.
So what are some ways in which you learned that you can predict the weather?
Well, one thing that that has really, really stuck with me for a long, long time is, you know how sometimes you'll be walking outside, it'll be a cloudy day, but then all of a sudden there'll just be this yellow light. Like the sky takes on a bit of a yellowish hue. That is typically the sign of an impending storm. But but you can kind of call it the, for lack of a better term, I've often referred to it as a golden sky, because it's almost as if it's like letting everyone know with a cautionary light that it's like, it's I'd sit back, enjoy, I'm about to put on a show kind of thing, you know? And it's just, it's kind of cool that that even weather will give its own styles of warning, you know, very similar to that, you know, even one thing that I think a lot of people have a tendency to sort of see such things as like cumulonimbus clouds. Like those are your massive, massive storm clouds, right? The ones that go tens of thousands of feet high in the air.
Right.
And typically what those are is actually just a culmination of your cumulus clouds, which are your standard sort of puffy white ones that we look up in the sky and we say, oh, I see a rabbit, or, oh, I see, you know, the CN Tower, or we find the imagery in those clouds, you know. But when those gather together, you know, they can create a fairly ominous looking storm cloud. But I will say this, as somebody who has also traveled from above or from a distance, those clouds can be some of the most beautiful, most majestic imagery you've ever seen. Just this towering, you know, puffy, almost like a stack of whipped cream on the sky, you know? And while it may be gray and rainy underneath, I mean, above, it's just pure beauty.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. I was always told, you know, when you see certain leaves on plants, if they're flipped over and you see their underside, in other words, some of them have more of a whiter hue on the backside of the leaf, that means rain is coming.
Yeah, no, and it is one of those things too, where it's like, I mean, even stepping away from the weather itself, plant life is another great example of like, you know, how just nature seems to work in sync with one another. You know, whether it's animals or plants or whatever the case might be, it's like they are so in tune based on experience and instinct. And you know, it's to be in tune with weather patterns, I just find is just like, it creates this feeling of, I don't want to go so far as to say catharsis, but it definitely creates, you know, a feeling of connection with everything around you. And yeah, seeing things like plants turning over their leaves, or even simply the way that plants will naturally lean towards the source of sunlight. If you watch even a house plant that sits in a window on a sunny day, there is tiny incremental movements over the course of the day as it follows the sun. We used to have flowers back when I was living in Toronto. I was living in a house in the annex, and up the front porch we had morning glories. And I don't know.
Oh yes,
those flowers, they're absolutely stunning, but they only bloom in the morning, and then they close up for the rest of the day, because they're essentially trying to capture a mixture of moisture and sunlight at the point of the day where dew is typically rising or steam is rising or whatever the case might be. And then they close up for the remainder of the day so as to protect themselves from weather patterns. And even just seeing that sort of instinctual non-sentiary behavior, it really is fascinating.
Sure, sure. Let me ask you this. So you've mentioned Toronto, and in case our listeners are like, what did he mean when he said the CN Tower? That's a tower that's in the middle of our, right in the heart of our city. That is a very, very tall tower. It was once the tallest tower in the world. Now I think it's just the tallest self-supporting tower. I could be wrong, but having said that, PK, do you miss the snow since you're not here right now and there's a bit of snow on the ground here? You're in sunny California. And if so, what do you miss from it from a weather perspective?
When it comes to snow, I definitely do occasionally miss the snow. I mean, one thing that I'm sure a lot of people will make fun of me for saying is moving to California, you sort of sacrifice the experience of seasons. Right?
Sure.
Every day sort of outputs very, very similar weather.
Yeah, it seems, Paul, that every day in California, in Southern California, is a glorious, beautiful day.
This past week has been a little bit on the colder side, comparatively speaking. Obviously, it's not getting down to freezing temperatures. But yeah, for the most part, it's you know, generally very nice and temperate weather. But you do occasionally, you know, especially as a Canadian, I definitely find that I miss the experience of watching snowfall or watching it slowly accumulate. And I mean, while it does come with its fair share of frustrations, be it ice or slush or whatever the case might be, there, like watching one of those like big chunky snowflake days, you know, what they refer to as kissing snow.
I didn't know that. I know that as like, you know, the snowflakes that land on your eyelashes and just sit there in big clumps.
Yeah.
Kissing snow. I love that.
Yeah. Well, and I believe it earned its name mainly because it is just so atmospheric, right?
Right. Of course.
And, you know, whenever movies have those like, you know, those kissing scenes around Christmas or whatever the case might be, usually they opt for, whether it is synthetic or real, usually they're opting for the thicker snowflakes, more of an impact. And yeah, even just that name of it, I think it's just so fitting because there's a certain romance about the way that snowflakes will dance through the air, you know, especially when before I moved from Toronto, we were living down by Lake Ontario, like right on the edge of the shore. And with the lake effect wind that would come in, you know, sometimes you'd look out the window and it was snowing upwards. You know, these snowflakes were sort of scooping up and all of a sudden heading back up into the sky. And that is actually, I think, one of the cool things that people don't realize is that the size of snowflakes actually is dictated by how many times it's cycled back up into the air and refrozen. And
kind of like hail too, right? Hail does that same sort of thing.
Yeah, very, very similar to that. Yeah. And it's just kind of cool to think that it's just sort of like it kind of creating its own snowballs in the air, you know, until it's too heavy for to suspend in the air and gravity does its job. But
right.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, I used to get lost in just sort of watching that beautiful dance.
It's so funny. You know, we are fortunate. We have listeners from all over the world who listen to this podcast, and I'm so grateful to all my listeners. Thank you for listening once again. But I often talk about very uniquely Canadian or, you know, cold weather country things like snow. And so they hear us talk about these things in great detail. I think I had an episode where we talked about putting on hockey skates, and the whole episode was talking about this sort of task of putting on hockey skates. But it makes me laugh because, you know, being in a cold weather climate and dealing with snow, we often have these sort of unwritten knowledge of different types of snow. So if I was to say to you, you know, that snow that lands and when you step on it with your boots, it makes a squeaky crunching sound, you would know what that snow is that I'm talking about.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Or the kissing snow, or that first little bit of snow that's kind of powdery and it's almost like little balls and you could just sweep it off your porch. You don't even need a shovel. It's so thin and powdery.
Almost like dandelion puffs.
Yeah, but it always comes with a really cold snap. It's always like, oh, it's cold. And all it is this, these little tiny balls, almost like dandelion fluff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Or even just the term flurries.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And I love that term for flurries, which we use to reference blowing gusts of snow, correct? Is that how you would describe a flurry?
Typically, yeah. It's blowing gusts, but also very, very small snowflakes. So
right.
You know, they can sometimes move so fast that you barely register them and like, you turn them in the same direction.
And I love when that term, that word flurry, gets taken and used in our national sport, hockey, when they talk about a flurry of pucks heading towards the goalie. And you'll often hear that used. I know that because my cousin always uses flurry for anything that's happening. He's like, oh, it's like a flurry of cars were coming towards me. Or, oh, man, I was swimming. It was like a flurry of boats were driving by me. It's like I say to my cousin, I'm like, you're always talking about flurries of things. He goes, I guess I just watch too much hockey. And it's a really funny thing. But, you know, we're talking about all this weather and this imagery, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And that brings me to a lovely segue to the fact that Paul Kingston is a prolific writer, and you have 3 published short stories, and you have 3 books, one of which you're giving your readers in chapters right now. And PK, the names of your short stories are?
There's Feast, Sweet Mary, and A Pound of the Devil's Flesh.
Ooh, A Pound of the Devil's Flesh. Yeah. Sounds like a children's novel.
No, it's a Western horror, which was something that sort of jumped out at me as a genre that's not really touched on as much as it could be.
Might we see some of these short stories or your novels turned into screenplays and on the screen, starring both you and perhaps your lovely wife, who we've had on the podcast as well?
That's the hope. Absolutely. Obviously, with this industry, not keeping my fingers crossed. But yes, for sure. I hope that is the eventual result.
Well, I wish it for you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I'd like to talk about your writing, if I can.
Absolutely.
All right. So what brought you to writing short stories and novels is my first question.
Similar to yourself, I started with an acting background, and, you know, working in comedy, we naturally, you know, quickly discover that the easiest way to get ahead in comedy is to create your own work as opposed to waiting to book something.
Indeed.
I started, when I first moved back to Toronto from college, I very quickly, started falling into sketch writing. And for those that don't know, that's very, very short comedic scenes, often slice of life humor. So I started working on those. And the more that I was writing sketch comedy, the more I started to realize, you know, there was a potential career in screenwriting and so on and so forth. And it was around 2015 or 2016. I was still back in Toronto, and I decided I was going to write my first screenplay. I had skipped right past the idea of even considering writing books or novels. And in the process of writing the first few pages of my first screenplay, I very quickly, because the scene was basically one man walking down the street by himself.
Okay.
And so it was predominantly, you know, stage directions or you know, action notations as opposed to dialogue. And as looking at that as an actor, I sort of looked at it and, you know, I have a habit of being somewhat critical of myself and critical of my work, and as any Canadian does. And I was looking over these pages and saying, oh, you know, this is reading so heavy. This is almost reading like it's a novel. And then suddenly something clicked and I was like, okay, first attempt was, you know what, I'm going to try to write this out in a literary sense so that I can go back and then harvest what I need for the screenplay. And next thing I knew, as I was writing page after page after page of this opening scene, I started realizing this is less of an opening scene and more of a prologue. And so naturally, I just sort of sat there. I sat on that probably for a couple months, maybe showed it to like one or two friends who emphatically loved it.
Oh, wow.
And so I was just like, okay, well, maybe, you know, I need to continue writing it this way to sort of see what it needs to be. And around that time, a friend of mine that I was working with for a comedic musical had actually introduced me to a website that they worked for called Wattpad.com. And basically it's an sort of, I guess you could say it's a launching pad for up and coming literary writers. And so I decided, you know what the heck, I'm going to load it up there, sort of see what people think, see if it gets a response. And within a month, I had a couple hundred reads on the prologue and people were loving it. So I uploaded the next chapter and that got a couple hundred reads. And yeah, and it just sort of spiraled from there. And currently that first book in its completion is now sitting at, the last I checked, I think it was approximately 243,000 reads.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's Wattpad, WATTPAD.com. But we'll have it in our show notes in case anybody wants to take a look at what Paul is writing. That's so exciting, Paul. Mm-hmm. Isn't it just so overwhelming when you see so many people reading what you've written and how the reach that it has?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I'd say that's probably one of the most amazing things about that platform just in general. And I'm not trying to do a product placement. This is purely based on personal experience. But like you said, the reach is sort of has probably been the most astounding thing because one of the features is that I can check in with the demographic of readers that I have and sort of get a sense of who's reading this and where they're reading it from. And for the most part, you know, I mean, I was expecting the majority of the audience to come from North America as a whole.
Sure.
And while there are a sizable chunk of readers in Canada and the United States, one of my top three countries for readership is Indonesia.
Amazing.
And I never saw that coming. And go figure, you know, it's like it's a sizable fan base. And the other added bonus is that you get direct contact with these readers. You know, they have the ability to comment on the book as they're reading it or leave little thoughts along the way. And
wow.
It's just it's amazing because it creates sort of a connectivity to your fan base that is really sort of unprecedented in regards to the literary world.
I should mention your book titles are Goats from Lambs,
mm-hmm.
Butterflies in Glass Cases,
mm-hmm.
Michaela's Monsters, or mm-hmm. Michaela's Monster, rather.
Yeah.
And then you've got some short stories as well.
Yes.
So that leads me to, how do you go about finding the title for your books?
Yeah.
Butterflies in Glass Cases.
Butterflies in Glass Cases was a little bit more focused around, I've spent the majority of my life in various capacities working with kids. I mentioned summer camps earlier. I've also been a youth and teen improv and sketch comedy instructor for upwards of 11 years now. So I've worked with children for the majority of my life. And so I knew I wanted to write some sort of story that had to do with the connection with children.
Sure. Okay.
And this story specifically is a little bit more derived from Celtic folklore. And essentially what it is sort of your traditional approach of someone gets an offer to work in a remote home as sort of like a au pair, if you will, or someone
sure.
to help oversee the house and assist with the children. In this story, I don't want to spoil too much of it, but in this story, basically the bond between this person who has moved to this remote home and the two children who live there becomes very, very, it becomes very, very strong bond between them. And there's suppositions about odd things that are happening around the home and so on and so forth. And that creates some contention between this lead character, Patty Woodall, or Patricia Woodall, who goes by Patty, and Ms. Pierre, who is the matriarch of the home. Anyway, long story short, there is sort of the Butterflies in Glass Cases was sort of intended to insinuate the beauty of childhood being contained by stipulations and rules and so on and so forth. And it very quickly becomes a focal point for the main character to want to essentially free these children of the thumbs that they're living under.
Interesting.
And so that imagery of a butterfly in a glass case sort of really, really jumped out at me as really embodying that kind of mentality. And sure enough, midway through the story, there is actually a direct reference to one of the children who has a butterfly in a glass case.
I see.
And yeah.
Well, listen, you said to make a long story short here on the Insomnia Project. We like to make short stories long.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to take you back to that book and I'm going to say, where do you get your names from? I always find it tricky to figure out when I'm writing a protagonist or an antagonist's name. Mm-hmm. You've got Patty, you've got Mrs. Pierre, you've mentioned mm-hmm. one of your books. I believe there's going to be a Michaela in it,
yeah.
hence the title. Where do these names come from? Where do you draw these names? And I find last names tricky.
Yeah, no, I've used various tricks over the years. Because of the fact that I had, over the course of writing these three books, I had lived in two cities between two countries. I did have sort of an added advantage of just searching street names. And often I'll just sort of look for out of the way, sort of residential street names, that jump to me that sort of speak to the voice of the character or the attitude of the character. But sometimes the names just come very organically. So for instance, with Ms. Pierre, and her full name in the book is Ms. Rosalind Pierre. I just felt that, the use of Ms. combined with, you know, the full use of Rosalind in place of Roz and then right. Pierre, all three of those just very spoke very cleanly to me as a sort of stern, approach to life or a very, you know, structured, partly because, I, when I was in college, I was over in Quebec, and we were living in a English speaking town surrounded by, the Eastern townships, which are predominantly French, very, very French speaking. And, there is a lot of contention there in that regard. And so I knew I wanted to have some sort of French inflection upon it because to me, and this is not meant to be a blanket statement, this is more based on my experiences while living there. It was just like, no. When you're, you know, out amongst the locals, you adhere to their way of life and you try to speak French and you try to, respect all that sort of thing as opposed to, you know, coming in and, you know, causing a scene. As college students have a tendency to do.
Sure, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. So I knew that spoke to me in that regard. And yeah. But I think the biggest key to it is just sort of finding names that really sort of embody the voice. You know, if it's somebody who's going to be a little bit more relaxed, then they're probably not using the most formal version of their name.
Fair.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned, you know, using street names and both PK and myself, we're skilled improvisers and we've been improvising for many years. You teach it currently as well. Mm-hmm. And so whenever I'm doing improv in the scene, generally speaking, I have two names that I'll use, which is Franklin for male characters and Margaret for female characters. And I don't know why those names are the ones that come to me, but all my friends who I perform with always know that I use those characters. And one time we were performing in the US in Chicago and Los Angeles. And I said, I can't always use the same names. And someone said, well, why don't you use street names? So then all of a sudden I started to have characters like Jane and Dr. Eglinton and Mrs. Cothra. And, you know, I was just using street names in my town that the people in the area where I was performing would not have, you know, realized that I'm using actual intersections
oh, yeah.
as people's names. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and it I mean, that is a really, really great way to do that. And that is actually advice that I give to a lot of my students is I tell them, you know, it's like, don't default to the, I definitely have found like my teen students specifically have a tendency to default to the classics like Billy and Jimmy and those
sure.
sorts of things, right? And I just say to them, I'm just like, you know, you don't have to default to the easy names. Just give yourself five stock names that you can pull from. Or as you said, go from something familiar like street names or company names or something like that, you know?
It's so much fun.
Oh
my
yeah.
goodness. Well, listen, you can find Paul's work on his website, paulpkkingston.com. and that'll be on our show notes, as well as seek out his writing at wattpad.com. That's WATTPAD.com. Once again, you'll find that in the show notes. Paul, it's been such a delight to have you. This 26 minutes just flew by.
Absolutely.
Or should I say, it was a flurry that came and went, and I had a great time from top to bottom.
Thank you. I did as well.
Great, Paul. Let us know when you have more things coming out that you want our listeners to know. You're always welcome to be a guest on the Insomnia Project.
Thank you so much. Absolutely well.
And thank you to all our listeners. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Coming from both Toronto, Canada, and Los Angeles, California, we hope you were able to listen and sleep.